and it's worth $2,500 if you were to go into any mainstream firm and ask for this amount of attention. But we're allowing and we're giving, at the grace of this opportunity with Lawyer and Mensa, you'll be able to have this consultation and look at your own picture, your financial picture, and create that blueprint, create that plan. And what we are giving you with this bonus, the DVD, The Secret, that is to help you with your motivation. That is to help you with your understanding of the mindset and the discipline and the way that you can move through your life in a with the energy, with a mental picture, with a strength of heart and purpose, so that when you access that financial plan, when you begin to take those steps, you're determined to make it work. It's a beautiful opportunity. 212-209-2950 is your number to call, and I will go back to this interview once I receive your phone call. 212-209-2950. It's one of those things where I'm going to give it a little more of an effort. We're going to go back into the interview, and we're going to hear more about how Loyon works with his own staff and how he works with the people that are being counseled to really change their perspective on how to move down this path of financial independence. And we reach financial independence through a financial IQ. We want to be able to understand how it works. We want to understand how to contribute to that blossoming of abundance within our lives. 212-209-2950 for the financial checkup. It's a pledge of $100. And for that $100 pledge, you not only get the one-hour personal consultation, you also get the bonus of the DVD called The Secret. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I'm going to go back to the interview and share just a little bit more. And as we go back, I want to remind everyone that you are listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. Again, that number is 212-209-2950. Show your support for WBAI. This is a listener-supported radio station. Non-commercial. So that means that we can bring you information that is for your greatest benefit. That means that we can cover the news in ways that mainstream media will not. It means that we are going to have guests and we have hosts who are part of your community, who understand what it's like to move through this world with the challenges that we face as a humanity, as a people, as a community. We all have challenges that we face in our lives, and WBAI is here to help you meet those challenges. And this is just one more opportunity for you to do that. 212-209-2950. It doesn't help to stick our heads in the ground when we have challenges in our lives. And one of the greatest challenges of our times are finance. To be able to know how to build from very little and be able to sustain our lives through financial intelligence, through coherent choices, through proper education, it's a very powerful thing. And this is a tool we're offering to you for your support for WBAI Radio. 212-209-2950. For your $100 pledge, you'll receive the one-hour personal financial checkup, and you'll receive the bonus DVD of The Secret. And in this checkup, you'll get help analyzing your financial situation, just laying out the whole picture. And there'll be steps you'll receive recommendations on how to increase your cash flow, on how to reduce your debts, on how to make your money work for you, how you can decrease your taxes. plan for college education, be it your children or maybe you want to go back to school yourself. Planning for your retirement. And wouldn't we all like to retire young so that we can have a full enjoyment of that retirement stage of our life? Having that emergency fund should we get sick, should we need to pay copays or whatever it is that we need, we want to be able to provide not only for ourselves, but for the ones we love. And you can provide for the ones you love through information, through education. With this financial checkup, you may want to send your child, you may want to send your father or mother, you may want to attend yourself, but there's an opportunity to build this intelligence, not just for yourself, but for your family and for your community. And it's time that we began to take control. It's time that we begin to take control of our lives in such a way that we can benefit our experience, benefit our lives, benefit our family by the choices that we make. 212-209-2950 is your number to call. It's only a pledge of $100, and you can't beat that for this financial checkup, which is worth so much more. And you're also getting the DVD, The Secret. The Secret is not really a movie or documentary. It's more of a video seminar, a presentation featuring a series of authors, philosophers, doctors, quantum physicists, entrepreneurs, and spiritual practitioners talking about the powers of the secret. But it's basically the powers of understanding how to manifest into the world. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. I'm going to take you back to our talk with Loyann Mensa. And again, you're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis, and this is a conversation on financial intelligence, on living from your own power and with an understanding of how these principles work. 212-209-2950. A $100 pledge for the financial checkup and the bonus DVD, The Secret. So since we are looking at people from the perspective of their financial health and their financial intelligence, when a person comes in to see you, I would like to just give, you know, maybe three scenarios. Let's say someone comes in. We heard that one. Let's go. Let's try this again. In New York, 99.5 FM. WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis, sitting down with Loyann Mensa, and we have been talking about financial intelligence and really how to have a healthy life with regard to your resources. And I want to welcome you back, Loyann. Thank you for having this conversation with me.
Thank you for having me here.
And one of the things that I've noticed that is really very, very useful and very cool is that you work with people on a fundamental level of how they can transform their inner feelings and their inner thoughts about who they are, what they're capable of, and how to have a relationship, a healthy relationship with finances and abundance.
Yes.
And you use different kinds of tools to help people. And one of the tools that you use, we're going to talk about today, and it's actually something that's been around for a while. It's mm-hmm. a DVD called, and a book, I believe,
yes.
called The Secret.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was very popular, but I'm not sure that people really integrated how to use this information. And that's what I'm hoping that you can help us with today, to really go into what's being taught and how to use it. So how would you start off with someone teaching them how to use this as a transformative tool?
You know, I've learned that the best way to teach something is by being an example. And for certain items, even when it comes down to words, some people say, you know, I can't, or I'm going to try. Those are self-defeating words. So I'm big on being mindful of even what I share or what I say from a body language, from a tonality, from a even the words that come out my mouth. Everything is important. So when it comes to the book or the DVD or the movement, the secret movement, the reason why it's important for me is because it has literally transformed my life. Mm-hmm. Before I knew what the secret was, I was living a life where I used the secret's principles, which is the law of attraction. And I just didn't know I was doing it. You know, I leveraged other books and, you know, just a combination of different things that I've read and different people I've surrounded myself with. I was able to leverage the law of attraction. Now, after reading the book and watching the DVD, I was able to really turn it from a huge light or a bright light to a focused laser and be able to really focus on exactly what the principles say. You know, from a dynamic of, you know, we all work from a level of infinite power, right? We are one with the universe if we choose to be. Everything is a choice. We have to decide to be successful. We have to decide to be satisfied. We have to decide to be happy. And even in the word decide, when you break it down, C-I-D-E, side, is usually in words that deal with death, right? Suicide, homicide, pesticide, right? It's in words that deal with death. So in the word decide, it means to kill off the alternative. So if you decide to be happy, you have to kill off the alternative of being sad. If you decide to be wealthy, you have to kill off the alternative of being poor. Now, wealth is not just in money. It's in your mindset, is in your spirituality, is in your physicality. Wealth is just living a life of abundance. So from the standpoint of the secret or law of attraction, it starts by saying, okay, understanding, coming back to the power of thoughts are things. So if I believe that I deserve something, it will come to me. But it's not saying that, okay, you believe that you deserve $1 million, so $1 million comes to you, right? It's what it's basically saying is you have to believe and then go do. Because in order to show faith or show belief, belief is in the action. Belief is in the doing. If you want to live a life of satisfaction, even in satisfaction, it's the word action. So in order to be satisfied, you have to take action in your life to be satisfied. Too many individuals sit back and hope for the best. So in the word satisfaction is the word action. And knowing that in order to live a life of satisfaction, in order to live a life of abundance, you have to take action. You have to do. You believe something, and in showing your belief, in order for something to come to reality is when belief and action come together. That's faith. So the foundation of the law of attraction, the foundation of the secret, is in practicing faith. And that's really what helps me, or helped me, continuously helps me. And when I sit down with anyone, regardless of what we're talking about, if we're talking about finances, if we're talking about life, if we're talking about love, relationships, everything comes down to your belief factor. Too many people blame their outer world. Too many people blame their situation on outside circumstances. You see, it's not about being a thermometer. It's about being a thermostat. You see, a thermometer, when you put a thermometer in your mouth, if your body temperature is 90 degrees, then a thermometer will say 90 degrees. Too many people are thermometers. They let their outside environment affect their temperature, their life temperature. But when you understand the power of being a thermostat, you see, a thermostat changes the environment, changes the temperature in the environment. So we have to learn how to be thermostats. And then using those principles within the book, The Secret, or viewing it and listening to it on the DVD, you learn how to become a thermostat. And I love being able to walk into a room and changing the energy, making it positive. Just because I walk into a room and it can be all negativity, it doesn't matter, because as long as I'm the thermostat, I change the temperature.
So that's a very powerful concept for people to get their heads around, that they actually have this power.
Yes.
So how would you recommend people start with this process? And I know that, you know, we're going to be playing little bits from The Secret, the DVD, for people to hear from. What would you recommend? What segments would you recommend that people, that we could play? And what would your accompanying message be about that segment?
I love the message in its totality. I mean, it's the dynamic that the secret is the law of attraction. Every aspect of it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So people really just need to watch the whole film.
Yes. And I would even take it beyond it and not say watch it, but experience it.
Well, explain that.
When you go watch a movie, right? Individuals go watch a movie and then leave and say, man, that was a great movie. Because to them, it was a great movie. The secret is not a movie. It's an experience. It should be part of you, right? So is the difference between hearing and listening. When you hear a message, you hear because you have ears. So if you watch the video and you hear the audio of what they're saying, then you're just hearing the message. But listening is listening with your mind, listening with your heart, listening with your soul. You got to let it be a part of you. Because once it's a part of you, there's no letting go. So even when you remove yourself from reading a book or remove yourself from watching a DVD, you're walking with the secret.
Mm.
And that's key. Learn that if you really want to get something out of a book you read or an audio you listen to or a video you watch, you have to stop hearing the message and start listening to the message. And that's how you experience things.
So this is very good advice. I'm not sure that people quite understand the difference between listening and hearing. But probably if they're not walking away feeling substantially changed, then they probably could go back.
Yes.
And do it again.
Over and over again.
Until it becomes, the message becomes a part of their general consciousness and general awareness so that they'll remember it and remember to apply it.
Yes. And the beautiful thing is with the wonderful thing about having access to the DVD, which individuals will have access to, or the book,
mm-hmm.
they'll be able to refer back to it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a movie that you watch one time and say, hey, it was great, and that's it. I've listened to and read and watched The Secret numerous times because at different points in my life, 2 months ago, I was a different person.
Mm.
Yesterday, I was a different person. Every day, you're supposed to get better. So as you get better, when you review something you've seen before, you're reviewing it and listening to it at a totally different level.
This is so true, and I've also found that our lives in general have peaks and valleys,
mm-hmm.
and you might be humming along doing really great, and then for whatever reason, you wake up feeling defeated again,
mm-hmm.
and then it becomes your tool or your choice to decide, am I going to stay in this low state, or am I going to do something to change it?
Absolutely.
And that in itself is one of the principles that is in the movie,
mm-hmm.
in the DVD, The Secret, mm-hmm. one of the tools that at every juncture, whatever we may be experiencing, as you said, we have an opportunity to change the temperature and change our perspective. And it's important to have tools in order to do that. How important do you find it? You work with a lot of people, with clients, as well as people who are working with you in your business. How mm-hmm. important is it to be able to sustain that level of understanding and response, self-responsibility to change the temperature?
I think it's the difference between life and death.
Mm.
Now, not literally, but more so figuratively, because a business is built on people. So if you have people who are, you know, negative, upset, you know, grouchy or what have you, I don't think the business will strive. But if you have an environment of, you know, vibrance, of energy, of love, of encouragement, the business has no choice but to strive. So even within my office on Wall Street, it's totally different than probably any other office on Wall Street. Why? Because you walk in and sometimes there'll be music playing where, you see, music is, it touches your soul,
mm-hmm.
right? And so sometimes there'll be music playing. We create an environment where you walk in, and even if you felt horrible before you walked in, you're going to feel great as you're walking out, as a client, as an associate, because you have to create a peaceful haven for people. And the dynamic of The Secret, it speaks about the dynamic that you get whatever you're feeling. So you have to be so mindful of your thoughts. If you think that you're sick, chances are you'll become sick. If you think that you're not worthy of making a certain amount of money, chances are you won't make it. Have you ever been in a situation, and I simply ask this of individuals, where you were thinking about something so strongly, and then the next person that came around you either spoke about it or handed it to you or did something.
Absolutely.
That wasn't by chance. That wasn't coincidence. You thought it into reality because mm-hmm. your thoughts literally lead to your feelings. And when you feel something strong enough, it will lead to some kind of action. So as the book talks about the law of attraction, what you attract starts with a thought. Everything started with a thought, even depending on what you believe. But what I believe, even creation started with a thought. Everything mm-hmm. Think about the phones, the cell phones that we use now, the computers that we have now, the cars that we drive. Someone had to think this up before it was manifested physically. Someone had to think about it, and then that thought became a feeling. And when they were fired up enough to make it a reality, then the action happened. Mm-hmm. And the result is the fact that we can pick up a phone, press some numbers, and someone across someone on the other side of the world will pick up and we'll have a conversation. That all started because someone thought about it.
And this is very powerful because you're talking about something, a specific sort of flow or direction of this process, mm-hmm. but you're also including the feeling, you know, the thought, the feeling, the action. To me is a very powerful 1, 2, 3. Because very often people will engage in thoughts and think that that's enough. Like I know I do a lot of affirmations, and I know people who do affirmations or people who try to construct and manipulate and move things with their mind don't recognize that their feelings play such a big role in mm-hmm. whether or not those thoughts become true. And it's really just a matter of recognition, because you're going to have some feeling from your thought.
Yes.
The question is, what feelings are you creating? Are you paying attention to it? And are you paying attention to the relationship between your feelings and the world that you're living in? Mm. So can you speak to the fact that we really are creating a reality through this process?
We are. And as you spoke about that process, the last step right after, see, you have thoughts, you have feelings, you have action, then you have the result. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're in a job that you don't like, or you're driving a car that you're not a fan of, or you're in a, this one is big, you're in a relationship that you're not a fan of. Mm-hmm. That's the result. So either people are focused on the result, or they're focused just on the thought. Mm-hmm. And they believe that if they will it, it's going to happen. So the result is your current circumstance, your current situation. So in order to change the result, you have to see what action caused that result. In order to change that action, you got to see what feelings caused that action. And in order to change the feeling, you got to go back to the seed, which is the thought. So from the standpoint of being able to help someone along the way, it's really sitting down and having that dialogue and finding out which area they're stuck at. Because everyone's situation is different. Everyone, like some people are really good at, you know, visualizing. You spoke about affirmations. Affirmations are, in my opinion, very important. Mm-hmm. Now, even before your daily affirmations, the night before, I believe you have to pre-plan your day. Because in pre-planning your day, it helps with the visualization technique of saying, okay, tomorrow I will succeed in these areas. Once the day starts, in my opinion, it's too late. So the night before, you pre-plan your day. And you speak the affirmations the night before that these things will be accomplished because I'm doing them. That morning, I believe it's important to have peace in the morning. Just to kind of people talking about the most important meal of the day is breakfast. The most important part of the day to have peace is right when you wake up. So having a time for yourself where you can be grateful. That's one big thing that they speak about in the secret that I believe is extremely important. Having an attitude of gratitude. Mm-hmm. Imagine waking up every morning and writing out a gratitude list. Everything that you're grateful for. There is no way after doing that, you won't have a fantastic day. Regardless of what happens in a day, you won't have a fantastic day. Mm-hmm. So when you write down what you're grateful for, these are things that are actually happening in your life currently that you're grateful for. Then you speak your affirmations. You're affirming that things that didn't happen yet will happen. That charges you, your thoughts. It infuses for you to have a great feeling, and then the actions that you take throughout the day will confirm everything that you thought about. Mm-hmm. And then the resulting situation is a better day.
Wow, that's very clear advice, very powerful, clear advice to help people to, like you said, take that step back to the seed and then redefine how they're going to live their lives. I think very few people think about programming or at least planning the day, the next day, the night before. Most people just wake up and in a way, it's like you're putting on a backpack and you're just re-putting on the worries from yesterday, and then you trudge through the day again, and then you go to sleep with stress, and then you wake up, put the backpack back on. So you're like giving a different formula mm-hmm. for how we can begin to change a reality if it's a reality we don't want to keep.
Yes.
That's really very powerful. And when you have someone working in their finances, when they're changing their financial picture, mm-hmm. how do you advise them to use these techniques from The Secret in helping them to be steady in their plan? Because, you know, it's easy to make a plan. It's not always easy to stick to your plan. How do you combine those things?
One word. Why? The how, the what, the when is not as important as the why.
Okay.
Every person that I sit down with is highly important for us to realize or help them realize what the why is. You see, your why is what will get you up in the morning. Your why is what will take you to the gym to work out. If someone just had a heart attack and the doctor says if they don't work out, they won't live past 2 months, their why is they want to live. Mm-hmm. So in order for someone to stick to a plan, there has to be a why attached to it. And your why has to be strong. The how I can create for them. The how is the plan. Mm-hmm. The what is, you know, everything that we do. But the why, is it because they really, you know, they... Growing up, they didn't have much. Growing up, people told them that they weren't going to make it. And now they have an opportunity to be successful. That may be their why. Or is it because, you know, their child, you know, never had the lifestyle they wanted their child to have. And now they're sick and tired of it. And they really want to give their child a better life than they had. That's their why. But regardless of what it is, we have to start off with the why. The why is the seed. Mm-hmm. Or the why is the glue that will bring together the plan and them actually...
Following through. Mm-hmm. Excellent. And also in the movie The Secret, there's a lot of reinforcement because they have a number of people speaking, and they each have their own take on particular idea, but there's a lot of reinforcement, I feel, from speaker to speaker. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the advantages is that people who listen to it will find someone within The Secret that they can resonate with.
Yes.
You know, there might be one or two that don't fit you, but there's going to be another two or three that really going to hit home. So I find that that's the case. Have you found, I know you've been sharing this with people and having people listen to it. What have been some of their responses and reactions to the film or to any of the particular speakers in the film or the messages in the film?
I can actually give you a personal story.
Okay.
The reason why...
And you are tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis, and you've been listening to an interview with Loyan Mensa, and he is a financial advisor. He has a company on Wall Street, the World Financial Group, I believe it's called, and he is offering his services of himself, his colleagues, to serve WBAI and to provide for you an opportunity to transform your life, to upgrade your financial intelligence, to have a personal consultation on what would work best for you, to look at the picture of your own finances, to build a financial blueprint that will guide you to where you want to go. And what's really beautiful about this particular person, Loyan Mensa, and his organization is that he works from the perspective of understanding and catering to the whole human being. So he not only looks at the picture of what needs to be done in order to accomplish your goals, he also helps to encourage you, to sustain you, to uplift you, so that you can make it to through that picture, through that plan, and find yourself in an uplifted financial situation. And I think that we all can benefit from this. We're asking you to make a pledge of support in the amount of $100 when you call 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Now, we have been speaking about the DVD, The Secret, because this is one of the tools that Loyan uses when he works with people and when he trains his own staff, because he believes that people can fundamentally transform themselves, their energy, their perspective, their thinking, so that as you're moving through this process of transforming your life in terms of your success, in terms of your ability to prosper, that it's more than just something on paper. It's something that comes through you. It's an energy that comes through you. It's a vibration. It's a consciousness. It's a feeling. And so he works to support you on all these levels of being. And that's going to have a broad effect on your life, not just with your finances, but with other aspects of your life as well. 212-209-2950. And for your pledge of support, a $100 pledge, you'll receive the financial checkup. And that's a one-hour personal consultation that's worth at least $2,500. You're going to get help in analyzing your financial situation, recommended steps to increase your cash flow and to reduce your debts, how to make your money work for you, stay ahead of inflation, how do you work on budgeting your spending so that your money can grow rather than just go out the window.
And that program was brought to you on recording. And good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. It's also dedicated to raising some money this morning, but more importantly also to our guest, Matthew Kressel. Stay tuned.
Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Here's a funny little question for you. If there weren't a bunch of nutjobs going around insisting that the Earth was 6,000 years old and Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a stegosaurus, do you think Pixar would have felt compelled to open their new animated film, The Good Dinosaur, with a prologue showing the asteroid that was supposed to kill the dinos bypassing the Earth, resulting in giant lizards evolving into thinking, talking creatures while humans coexisted beside them as little more than feral, canine-like beasts, just so there could be no confusion by anybody that this wasn't a documentary? I mean, the Flintstones didn't need a disclaimer, neither did 1 million years BC. But with the intelligent design people around, maybe you just have to cover your bases. Or maybe, computer nerds that they are, the Pixar folk just wanted people to know that they know that it didn't happen this way. As if having your main character be a cartoony-looking apatosaurus named Arlo wasn't signal enough. I don't know. Anyway, The Good Dinosaur doesn't really bother itself much with exploring the quote-unquote controversy. Although a bunch of pterodactyls do turn up who behave like shady revivalist preachers, so maybe the whole young Earth thing did stick in somebody's craw there. Most of the film is just good entertainment, not really the powerhouse emotional roller coaster that Inside Out, the Pixar film that came out earlier this year, is. But how many films could be? The Good Dinosaur was a notoriously troubled production, so much so that it got pushed back a year so a new director, Peter Sohn, could try to fix things. He hasn't quite cleared the bar in all regards. The basic setup is intriguing. Take a John Ford Western, think something like The Searchers, and swap dinosaurs for humans. You've got your homesteading apatosauri, a loopy mountain man, Styracosaurus, voiced by Sohn himself, Tyrannosaurus cattle ranchers, stuff like that. And if you look at the film's individual beats, there is a lot of great stuff there, including some fantastic dino-on-dino battles, great character animation, and just great distinctive characters. Pixar is one of the few studios that doesn't feel compelled to shove obnoxious pop culture references into its characters' mouths. More studios could learn that. And, yeah, there's a heart-tugging finale as well. I cried again. I always cry at Pixar films, damn them. But the bumps in the retooling do show, largely in the setup that sees young Arlo, the apatosaurus voiced by Raymond Ochoa, swept away from his family's farm when he falls into a river and has to make the treacherous journey home, accompanied only by a wild human boy that Arlo names, what else, Spot. Spot's an amusing little puppy boy, by the way. Some of the film's best character animation goes into him. The plot during the early going is dismayingly rote, with bits pulled straight from the well-worn Disney playbook. It's not a good thing when Arlo's dad begins talking in the benevolent tones of Jeffrey Wright, and your first thought is, oh yeah, he's not long for the world. 15 minutes later, cue the flood. Guess they didn't have any wildebeests in stock that day. It doesn't help that they cadged the fatherly counsel from beyond the grave bit from The Lion King as well. Whatever you think happened to the dinosaurs, can we maybe get a consensus that there are some story beats that should be extinct by now? It'd be hard for any animated film to live up to Inside Out, although there is another film, not out of Pixar this time, that does come close, and we'll hopefully be talking about that in a couple of weeks. Look at it this way. The title is The Good Dinosaur, not The Great Dinosaur. And it's a good film, not a great film. And good is still good enough, in my book. But if dinos on the prairie are not your thing, maybe you're more up for futuristic gang wars, because who isn't? The Japanese film Tokyo Tribe, which came out on home video this week, is a chaotic hip-hop musical, you heard me, that's kind of like Streets of Fire run through a pachinko machine. Never mind the plot's nonsense. It boils down eventually to the numerous tribes of a futuristic apocalyptic Tokyo joining forces to battle a renegade tribe leader. What matters here is that director Jean Sono keeps the beats going, keeps the mise-en-scene colorful, and keeps laying on the crazy. At one point, in the middle of a battle sequence, a bad guy deploys a machine that's a combination of an industrial fan and a Cuisinart. And the fact that it kills all combatants, regardless of whose side they are on, seems not to matter. I could have done with not having pretty much every character introduce him or herself in song. I've seen that weakness before in musicals. Some people need to learn that less is better. Save that stuff for the characters that really matter. And in this universe, it appears women can aspire to one of two careers, whore or training to be a whore. Odds are good that if you see a woman here, you'll soon be seeing her with her top off. If you can get around that, and I didn't have much trouble with it, what's a few pert boobies among friends? Tokyo Tribe is silly, action-packed fun with lots of wild martial arts sequences, good music if you dig hip-hop, and a septuagenarian DJ, which is always a plus. The film really is something. Exactly what, I'm not sure, but that's fine. And if you want something even more frenetic, as if there could be such a thing, but there is, there's The World of Kaneko, which is opening tomorrow, a Japanese noir thriller that's directed by Tetsuya Nakashima as if he was an emigre from a planet of caffeine-based life forms. Or at least as if he's got something to prove to Quentin Tarantino. It's all fractured timelines, stuttering jump cuts, 70s pop culture references, and a few animated sequences to boot, all in the service of the tale of a drunken, abusive ex-police detective who investigates the various and sundry depredations his missing teenage daughter has inflicted on her unwitting victims. The tone is a bit one-note, one relentlessly aggressive note, as the detective Koji Yukusho doesn't so much speak his lines as bark them, all of them, and the misogyny is pretty grievous. In this case, if you see a woman on the screen, you'll soon be seeing Yukusho call her a bitch, and probably punch her out for a capper. But Nakashima is clearly not reluctant to go for broke. He's offering a wild ride with The World of Kaneko, and if you can handle it, a wild ride is what you get, and I respect that. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. The new comedy horror film Krampus begins promisingly with a Christmas riot inside a department store. Crowds stampede, consumers are trampled, buckets of budget-priced holiday-themed cookies are strewn hither and yon. There are life-or-death tug-of-wars over the last Tickle Me Barbie. Director Michael Dougherty appears ready to throw down the gauntlet to look into the misery that frequently resides under the surface of the allegedly most wonderful time of the year, and deconstruct it in the form of a family so riven by all the anguish the 21st century can throw at them that they inadvertently summon the dread demon of the holidays, the Krampus, a hulking, deformed, chain-bedecked figure who, instead of strewing gifts, steals people with the help of his various demented playthings. That opening sequence, which takes place under the film's credits, actually, is the last time Dougherty will make his stand. Legend has it that when Joe Dante made the film Small Soldiers, he wanted to create the kind of vicious comedy horror he achieved with Gremlins, but he was overridden by DreamWorks and Burger King, who didn't want Dante wickedness getting in the way of marketing the film's action figure antagonists to a potential kid audience. The result was a compromise that pleased no one. You can see the same market forces warring with directorial intent in Krampus. For the film to fulfill its satirical intent, there has to be an arguable human awfulness going on, spurred by the pressures of the holiday season, sufficient enough to summon down the kind of grim retribution that only Eastern European culture can conjure. Problem is, somebody, and I'm going to presume it wasn't Dougherty, decided to optimize profits by emphasizing the holiday in holiday horror. Nobody in the expanded family in question, who have weirdly gathered 3 days prior to Christmas to spend the holidays together, is truly horrible. Conchata Ferrell, as an inebriated aunt, comes closest with some casual anti-Semitism, but even that character is soon reformed. As for the rest, which includes Adam Scott, Toni Collette, David Koechner, and Alison Tolman, their awfulness is either non-existent or so soft-pedaled that it barely matters. This film is so conflicted that near the beginning, it actually has the kid whose loss of youthful wonder brings down the Krampus curse, played well by M.J. Anthony, simultaneously proclaiming that he does and doesn't believe in Santa Claus. That's some bold storytelling right there. A few years ago, Michael Dougherty got some attention for his anthology film Trick or Treat. It was a little oversold, but there was something in the mix of humor and horror across those stories that showed how much Dougherty wanted to embrace the astringent, Dante-like attitude towards scary stuff. Krampus is not a fitting follow-up. Like Trick or Treat, the rewards are uneven. That opening battle scene, a flashback sequence done as a Rankin-Bass stop-motion animated Christmas special. Since Weta did the effects here, I'm guessing that was actually computer animated. And a lot of the humor does land effectively. But the sequences where the family is attacked by the minions of Krampus are so poorly choreographed as to be incomprehensible, squandering some cleverly designed animatronic monsters. They look like the work of the Kyoto brothers, but apparently are not. And there's a fade-out that would have been a great capper had proceedings been gutsy enough to set it up properly. As it is, Krampus promised a much-needed counterpoint to all the holly jolly, but in the end couldn't overcome the artificial goodwill that apparently is the mandatory attitude of modern-day Christmas. So instead of that, let me suggest something a little weirder and more honest in its goodwill that's debuting on demand tomorrow. Not a genre film at all, but a documentary. The Barkley Marathons, The Race That Eats Its Young, is about a foot race held annually in the forests of Tennessee, held in honor of James Earl Ray's failed escape from jail, and presided over by a guy who goes by the name of Lazarus Lake, who apparently has a few gleeful screws loose. Few manage to finish the full marathon, which runs over several days and multiple circuits. That is presuming that potential runners can find the race's application form to begin with, and then decipher Lake's cryptic route directions once there. The film, directed by Annika Iltis and Timothy Kane, captures the event in all its rarefied particulars. Not that many races require license plates as entry fees, and in the process presents a portrait of a competition where mutual support is almost as valuable as winning. This isn't sport as war, but as shared ordeal. Lake makes no bones about the fact that it is an actual competition and that those who participate are determined to come in first, but also has no problem celebrating those who at least make the effort, no matter how short of the goal they fall. That's an attitude apparently shared by all the participants, and there's admittedly a bit of masochism to their zeal. Runners show off the welts inflicted on their legs by a particularly vicious patch of brambles like they were medals of honor. The Barkley Marathons is a fascinating and surprisingly heartening look at an idiosyncratic branch of sports. I hate sports, but if they were all more like this, I could change my mind. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my My Teen Movie podcast website. So check out what you missed by going to MightyMoviePodcast.com. Holly jolly.
Philly. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial, I can't hear myself radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. The configuration in this room changes weekly. So I don't even know now where the headphone volume is. But you know what? I have reason to believe that I'm probably on the air. Otherwise, I'd see people calling on the phone,
except they put the phone where I can't see it. But hey, we've been here now for, what, you know, 5 or 6 months? And we've had a phone now for almost a month. Isn't that amazing? I love technology. But before we start talking to our guest, Matt Kressel, which is the plan this morning, I had not realized this was a fundraising drive morning. I thought that was starting next week when we have Jim Brissett on. And we have a spiffy premium, but you'll find out about that next week. Yes, fundraising, phones, technology, a roof to our leaping control room. Matthew and I are the only people in this building. We could still, if right now a motorcycle went down Atlantic Avenue, you, our listeners, would know it. Just like, you hear the Doppler and everything. It's real. You learn a lot of science listening to WBAI. You really do. And it is for that reason that I ask you to roll science back to a time when we have a roof over our heads, literally, and a soundproof studio, salaries to pay our, what, 8 employees? I think we're all the way up to 9 now. We were down to 7 about 2 years ago. So that's, you know, a major increase if you do it in terms of percentile units, down from the 150 or so from when one era during the 1970s. The point is that in all my years at WBAI, and there are many of them, I started as a teen, almost a preteen, an adolescent. 1967, I don't think I've seen the station as close to the brink as it is now, and we need your support. We need your help. We need you to become a listener sponsor, or to here's another important thing, and we need you to say that Hour of the Wolf is something that you want to make sure continues on WBAI. They look at those numbers. They take a look and they say, yeah, how much did he raise? Oh, you found the headphone volume? Would you turn mine up, please? Probably the first one. That's the box.
That's for this one.
Yeah, okay.
Is that it right there?
I bet you're right. Let's see. Yeah, those are my headphones.
It's probably somewhere on there.
It probably is. Let's see. Speakers. Nope. Not seeing it. Not going to spend too much time on it. Can you hear me, Matt? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Do you hear that tapping?
No. Yes.
You do hear me
yeah,
tapping.
Yeah, it's faint.
Okay. Let's... Oh, for God's sake. That's better now, isn't it?
There it is.
Yeah, I was.
I think you were across the room.
Yeah. You were hearing me through your mic.
Yeah.
Because I didn't flip this little chromium switch. For our Sign Theater reference.
Well, you're back now. Now
hello,
we can hear
we're
you.
Back.
Yeah.
As I was saying. Yes, and it's not only better to... Yes, and we need a better board. Let me just say that, or I would have known how to operate this. We need a better me also, but that's that. But I shouldn't ask you to donate for that, and also brain surgery costs so much money. But WBAI needs money, and we need you to become a listener sponsor. And the way that you do that is by dialing 2950. Yes, that number hasn't changed. We have all these new phone numbers here. They're all 718. I have been through so many
phone numbers through my years at WBAI. I remember the barter department, Oxford 78. Well, suffice it to say that it was Oxford whatever, you know. It wasn't just numbers or anything like that. We actually had, what do you call that, Matt? The first three numbers in a phone number. Not the
exchange?
Yes. It was an Oxford exchange number that we had. I grew up on an Illinois 7, but at WBAI, we were in Oxford 7. I won't give the number because they've all been reassigned. So one time I actually on the air dialed, at least it was during the day, I dialed some of those numbers just to find out who has them today. That was fun. I haven't done that in 10 years, though. But if I end up on the air one day, I'm going to just try it. But I'm going to ask you now to dial 212, because we're in Brooklyn, 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, and pledge your support. I'm asking you to pledge $25, because that is the cost of a membership to WBAI. It's very simple, $25, and you're a listener sponsor. Already a listener sponsor? Give a gift subscription. Call and make somebody you loathe a member of WBAI. See if you can trump them or something like that. 212-209-2950. We'll come back to this topic in a while. But good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
How are you? It's actually been a while. Well, okay, you were on the air at CUNY.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's.
But we were there for like 3 years? No, yeah. 2 years. How long were we there?
I don't know how long you were there. I was there.
I mean the radio station.
Right. No, I know what you mean.
It was about
2 years ago, maybe?
Yeah. A little more. It was about 5 months after Sandy.
No, it was later than that.
Was it? That we moved there? Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I was talking about when I was last on the air.
Oh, no. I meant how long were we at
At
CUNY, and mm-hmm. now we're here in Brooklyn at what? In a lovely building. I mean,
it's a great building.
It really is. It really is.
The cafe downstairs where you do your NERSIF readings.
Yep.
I think it's my favorite place because you've been.
And
the NERSIF
food
has been in a lot of places.
Yes, about eight now.
Eight, and
well, there were two Dixon places.
Mm-hmm.
There were two spaces in the South Street Seaport.
The Seaport was a great spot.
There were. It really was. It's now part of the Howard Hughes Corporation.
Mm-hmm.
There were Joe Monte had it at the New York Theater Workshop,
mm-hmm.
which is, by the way, is it the New York Theater Workshop? Are they doing a play based on The Man Who Fell to Earth?
Not sure.
With music by David Bowie, who played the man. Somebody's doing it. It's called Lazarus, and I think it might be the NYTW.
Okay.
But it's opening Monday.
Really?
The show's opening this Monday. So I'm going to be very curious to see that one.
Yeah.
So we were at the New York Theater Workshop. Then we were at the Vineyard
mm-hmm.
Theater for about 2 years when Cherie Renee Thomas was the curator. And we were thrown out so that the Vineyard Theater could bring in some play with puppets or something called Avenue Q.
Oh, some
stupid
play.
Stupid thing, yeah.
Yeah.
We were thrown out for that. And that's when we went back to Dixon Place, and we went from there to the Seaport.
Well, wasn't and then it was the
and then at the Soho Gallery,
the Soho Gallery for Digital Art,
which no longer, alas, exists.
Which was actually it's a boutique now, I think, right, or something.
It's if John Ordover has rented it out, he was trying to rent it out for a while. It was a boutique
mm-hmm.
that failed. That's gone. The people who were there.
It was kind of an odd spot.
Yeah, it's an odd spot, but it's a retail spot. And if he hasn't rented it, he's looking to rent it. We could probably have stayed there for a while. He would have loaned me the keys and stuff like that. But sooner or later, he's going to rent it, and then we would have gone
downstairs. I like this place. It's called the Brooklyn Commons Cafe downstairs.
Yes, exactly.
And I like that it has the camera so you can watch it live.
Well, that was something amazing. And we had no idea that was going to
happen. And so, you know, there are times when I have to work late, yeah. And I can't always make it here. And I'm like, oh, well, I could just put it on. So I put it on the TV, and my wife and I will watch the readings, and it's pretty cool.
If you don't want to listen to Matthew Kressel over WBAI in New York right now, see how I got that station break in? You can actually go to livestream.com, click on watch, and do a search on NYRSF, and you can watch Matthew reading from the same book he's going to be reading from this morning.
A different section, though. I'm going to be reading a different section today.
But you do it in stereo is the idea.
Yeah, you could put one in each ear and, you know.
Multitask.
You could read the book faster that way.
Yeah, and it's a three-camera setup, and Terrence Taylor, we walked in, we did in April, not knowing. I knew that Melissa, the owner of this building, was going to renovate.
Mm-hmm.
But I did not know how far she was going to renovate. And she said, oh, it's a cafe. But she had a real twinkle in her eye when we walked in. And Terrence took one look, and he saw this control room. And he's been
a kid in the candy store.
Oh, he's been a television producer of various kinds for 25 years or so. And PBS and Children's Television Workshop and some of the worst... He's written some of the worst animated television ever.
He also wrote one of the most famous You Can't Do That on Television episodes.
That's right.
Which surprised me because I remember... Like, they originally had banned it, apparently.
Yes,
it was about divorce. And then it came on later. And I remember watching it and thinking, like, boy, this is kind of dark, but it's great.
Yeah.
And because it was real.
And I think it's on YouTube. I think it's available. Yeah,
and he told me later that he wrote that.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. He worked on that whole series.
Yeah.
But he also did Sherlock Holmes in the 25th Century.
I don't think
Do yourself a favor. Just don't.
All right.
I know you and I disagree on certain movies and here and there, but you will agree on this. Terrence will agree on this. Don't.
Stay away.
Okay. Terrence said the paycheck was good. So he walks in, he sees that equipment, and he just said, Candy! And 90 minutes, that was the Samuel R. Delaney reading. 90 minutes later, he was doing crossfades and stuff. Last night, as we broke for intermission, I take a look on my phone. I love having my phone looking at the live stream app while the thing is going on. It's about a 60-second delay. But nevertheless, I'm looking at it and it says, intermission on it. We're doing titling now.
Mm-hmm.
We're soon enough, I'm thinking about actually having intermission interviews.
Hmm.
Having, you know, things like that. Because I can use my phone as a live stream broadcaster, so I can just actually, like, walk around and talk to people during intermission.
Yeah.
No reason not to.
It's a great idea.
Yeah. So it's very, very, very cool. So this is a great building. And
it is.
All lefty stuff, you know, it's all this progressive, the newspaper, The Independent, is based here. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of interesting stuff. But the cafe is a growing thing. The ever-changing menu. All new food since you were last there.
They have craft beer.
They have craft beer and wine. And what's it? Kombucha?
Kombucha, and they have... smoothies, right?
They have smoothies.
Yeah,
they have a nice little cafe. They have a coffee bar. They have pot pies. They have soups.
A little bit of everything.
It's starting to, people are actually now staying after the readings to eat, which is, because we always used to go out, but it's been improving.
Yeah.
So, it's cool. And you can go back, you the listener, can go back in time and watch Matthew from last month. Was it last month?
It was October...
Oh, 2 months ago then.
Third? October 3rd.
Yeah, October 3rd. And Matthew, I should mention, is, I constantly refer to the evil competition for the New York Review of Science Fiction Reading. You can't pronounce either word, and yours of their KGB. You know, it's KGB. It has to be evil. It's the KGB Fantastic Fiction Reading Series.
Well, it's Fantastic Fiction at KGB. So
yeah, that's right.
Right, so we're just at the KGB bar.
But and always been there, where we've had all these venues. When Terry Bisson and Alice Walker, I think were the...
Alice Turner.
Along with Mark Jacobson.
Well, when Mark Jacobson did it, it wasn't at the KGB bar. When it... the KGB bar series, when it started, the hosts were Alice and Terry Bisson and Alice Turner. But I believe Alice...
But Mark started it
with Alice at another location. Ellen Datlow will be able to tell you where. I don't remember where that was.
As I recall, Mark was the one who said, "Hey, I know this bar.
It's you possible, guys should do it there." But he may... I
had Mark on this show talking
according,
about
no,
it.
I believe you. But what I'm saying is, according to Ellen, unless I misheard her, that... the hosts at KGB, the first hosts, were Terry and Alice.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. But Mark...
But Mark brought them in
brought
to
them
the...
In. Mark was already doing a journalism series
That's right.
there.
That's right, yes.
And he told...
He had connections with Dennis
exactly,
at the bar.
Exactly, the owner.
Yeah.
So, and he convinced Terry and Alice to begin that series.
Ah. I'm glad they did. It's a great series.
And it's a great venue.
And, you know, you say, like, you know, I know you're joking, but it's evil competition. But the truth is, I mean, it's like, what do they say? Rising tide lifts all boats. I mean, it's like...
Let's put it this way. We would have less people attending if KGB didn't exist, and I hope the opposite is true as well.
Right. I mean, I think that...
I say on my website... you're assured of a great reading every fortnight.
That's right. I mean, each series has its own core crowd, but there's a lot of overlap.
I would say there's actually only about a 25 to 30% overlap of audience.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So I think it each serves a slightly different crowd.
I think the KGB crowd is more of the hardcore professional science fiction crowd. You get more editors, more writers. I think of KGB like a salon. Not what the readers do, but the people who attend.
I agree. And that was one of the main reasons why, when I was approached by Ellen to host, that I was hesitant, because I thought, oh, you know, crap, I'm going to lose the ability to schmooze with people.
And look who you were. You had a tough act to follow.
Gavin Grant.
And Kelly Link.
Well, you know, he has but that Scottish accent, so how could I follow that with my Long Island accent?
At least we no longer need subtitles to find out who's reading next.
I don't think it was that bad.
Oh, yes. Well, I have the recordings to prove it.
Yeah. Well, Gavin was great. Gavin was great. And
oh, we did that in sync. That was
good. Yeah, we did. That was good. But no, I mean, both series, I think, serve the community, and it makes it stronger. I mean,
we have
people meet at the series. They come to the reading and they meet and they say, "Oh, there's a whole group of people interested in the same things I'm interested
yeah,
in."
Yeah, our intermission yesterday went way too long because there was too much rubbing of elbows.
Mm-hmm.
It was 35-minute intermission. It's like no. Well, I'm including the raffle, but
yeah,
it was way too long.
Mm-hmm.
Way too long. I'll talk to the guest curator
about
that. But and people can just fast forward during it when you're watching it on live stream. But I think of the Nursef series that was started by Gordon Van Gilder 25 years ago as more of a proscenium kind of a thing. It's more of a staged show and more people off the street and listeners. And now that we're in this neighborhood in Brooklyn, in Borough Hill, I am going to really, really try to reach out to the people who live here, the locals, walk-in trade.
Yeah, I mean, the KGB bar, for example, is two flights up, or is it, technically, it's two flights up, and you're not going to just walk in off the street, unless you know it's there. You're not going to be like, hey, let's go to that bar two flights up in that old pre-war building and go to this.
I've seen a couple of
people will come in, but a lot of times what I
because
see...
Because they have different events, reading,
all the time.
Events all the time.
All the time, but a lot of times, like... will come
this
in.
This place has movies and dances and all kinds of
like Elle and I will come in, there'll be just people hanging out at the bar and have no idea that a reading is about to take place. And sometimes they'll stick around and sometimes they'll be like, this is not my scene, and they'd fly out of there, you know, which is fine. But yeah, it's been fun doing that. You know, I've been doing that since...
You've been doing quite a while now.
It will be 8 years this March, and that frightens me because it went by in a blink. I mean, it's wow.
Yeah, well, I've been working here. Let's put it this way: Hour of the Wolf began in 1972.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so you do the math,
right?
Okay, technically, I think we're going to be in our 45th year.
That's
as of January, our 45th year, something like yeah, that's right.
That's great.
Yeah, I mean it'll be the 44th anniversary, so it's the start of the
45th year.
So, geez, but both reading series are so spiffy and so wonderful. And we rarely, this is actually one of the very few times, we try to make sure that within a 3-month period, more or less, and it's not a strict rule, but we try to have a buffer so that we don't have the same readers.
You get the law of diminishing returns, right? Because if you have the same person reading like 3, 4, 5 times in New York City, you know, people aren't going to come out. They're like, well, I saw them read last week. I saw them read 2 weeks ago. Unless you're like, you know...
Delia Sherman. Because you're not... We had Delia Sherman
someone
last
like
night.
Joe Hill, who's you got like a huge... Like, you could do that. Not everyone's going to get that kind of turnout. And, you know, so we like to keep the place crowded and full and vibrant. And so we don't want to have too much overlap there.
Yeah, and, you know, likewise here. So for exactly the same... reasons, but the audience is somewhat different, and it's just always been that way.
Yeah,
and I've done my part to sort of make it like, well, we can do theater. We're going to do a play in May by Andrea Hairston. Now we did one last year, but oh my God, was that cramped in this space?
Yeah,
we can practically have blocking, and Andrea knows it. So that's going to be interesting. So, at KGB Fantastic Fiction, coming up in January, the third Wednesday of every month, by the way, you have...
Delia Sherman and Alana C. Meyer?
Yes. I'll have to ask her about that name thing. You know, I saw that name on a book and I said, I don't know who that is. And then later on,
yeah,
it's
you
like,
do know who
oh
it
my
is.
God, it's Alana!
Yeah, I'm not sure if she wants her...
That's why I said Alana.
Yeah. Her last name mentioned on the air. But, it's Alana C. Meyer. Last Song Before Night is her novel. It's out from...
No relation to E.C. Meyer.
That's Myers.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. But still no relation.
No, I'm not, like, you know, my last name is Kressel. I'm not related to John Kessel. It's different spelling there.
Exactly,
right,
exactly.
And even if
but,
we had
there's
the same
the proof
book.
Right there. Right. No, you're no... that's what I'm saying. Right. No relation to John Kessel. So, February?
I'm blanking. I could look it up for you on my phone right now because, like, Ellen, I'll be like, Ellen, who's reading in September 2017? She'll tell me, you know, like, she did. Yeah. For some reason, she remembers this, and I always have to look it up.
I can tell you what we're going to do in September 2016 at NeurSif. It'll be the 50th anniversary of the first broadcast of Star Trek.
Oh, that'll be nice.
Gordon Van Gelder's birthday, and by that...
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, he was born the day Star Trek went on the air, which is horrible, because I remember that day. So Keith DeCandido is going to guest curate, and we'll be doing a Trek thing.
Well, I also should mention this month, December 16th, is Sarah McCarry and CSE Cooney.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, which, you know... And then
we have her... in April, because we're doing a Clockwork Phoenix launch.
Claire Cooney, yeah.
Yes.
And then February 17th, Carola Dibble and Gemma Files.
Ooh, okay.
So...
I have to get Gemma back on this show.
March, we have Rio Ewers, David Nickel. April 20th, Elizabeth Baer, Scott Lynch. May 18th, Ellen Klages, Victor Laval. June 15th, Mark Laidlaw, Olivia Llewellyn. July 20th, David Levine. And there's more, but I don't put them all on the website.
And I'll just...
People change this far out.
So, as they were coming in the door yesterday...
Yeah.
For February 2nd, Groundhog Day, Richard Bowes and Richard Bowes... Well, it's Groundhog Day. So, and Barbara Krasnoff, because she hasn't read in a little while. And Rick and Barbara are, you know, like, part of the series. They're part of both series, really.
Yeah.
Rick really crosses over in many ways. And then March is to be determined. April is Clockwork Phoenix 5. And May is Andrea Hairston and a play.
Excellent. Sounds great.
Yeah, so everybody, you come to these readings, it is so much fun. Matt and I are also involved. Matt has an audio book out of King of Shards.
That's correct. I wanted to mention, Jim, to your listeners, if you're listening now or if you're listening on the archive, I am doing a raffle on my blog. So I'm giving away 5 copies of the Audible audiobook. It's narrated by Jonathan Davis. And Jonathan has narrated audiobooks for...
ever.
Forever, and for William Gibson, Paolo Bacigalupi, Star Wars novels, Neal Stephenson, everybody. Like, he's done... So I was just really honored and flattered, and he loved King of Shards, and he's really cool to work with. So I'm raffling away 5 copies... of the audiobook, and also
the CD or
it's the download.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the download. So basically I would email you the code to download it. And then I'm also giving away an ARC, an advanced reading copy of King of Shards. So they're rare.
I've got mine.
He's got one, which I need to sign after this. There's very few out there. I don't know how many
and
actually
I'll watch
were,
an audio
were printed.
Book if I can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So to enter the raffle.
And I realized that this was a pitching week. I would have asked for like a couple of copies of the audio book to give off. And we'll be giving out a different audio book next week.
Well, I was going to say, if you want to enter the raffle, you go to my blog. It's matthewkressel.net. Let me spell that for you. MATTHEWKRESSEL.net. And if it's not the first post, it's like the second post right now, but just search for raffle if you don't see it. All you have to do to enter is share that post. You share it on Facebook, you share it on Twitter, you share it on Instagram, share it on any social media site, and then comment with the link to that share. And then just tell me if you want the advanced reading copy or if you want the Audible audiobook. And on December 18th, I'm going to randomly select 5 people for the audiobook and 1 person for the advanced reading copy. And that's it. So all you got to do is share that post on my blog to enter. And that's it. That's my spiel for the raffle.
And we'll mention it again at the end of the show.
Yeah.
So you can write that down and and all that. So you have been writing short stories for years. You are closely affiliated with the Altered Fluid Writers Group, which has often, but not in years, had a space on this radio show. And by the way, wouldn't it be interesting to do one of those with an audience? This thought just occurred to me.
It would be.
We've done Matt's writers group live on the air.
Yeah. So what we did is we had I think we did it 5 or 6 times where we had one of our members read a story on the air, a first draft, and then we'd all critique the story as if we were in the writing groups. You know, usually we do it in someone's office, not on the air, of course. Obviously, we
This is bona fide reality radio.
Reality show, right?
Yeah.
Well, but we of course, had read the story before the radio show, but and, you know, had
just
our
as
critiques
you would be if you were doing it in somebody's office, you would have read it beforehand.
So it's exactly the same, except that
the person would read the story on the air.
Would read the story on the air, and then we would critique their story. And almost all of those stories have gone on to sell. And it's interesting. I mean, you can go back. I don't know if the archive still exists, but it would be interesting to see like what has changed. I mean,
might even be interesting to do a comparative reading.
Yeah, I mean, it's
like have the author, you know, like David or whoever.
One of the most interesting things that happens in a critique session is after everyone's given their opinions and after the author has said, okay, this is what I was trying to do, then there's this discussion that takes place. And everyone is kind of like steeped in the story for the last hour. This incredible creativity just pours out from everyone, and everyone just gets ideas from others. And they're like, what if you did this? And what if you did that? And everyone's like like the author is usually furiously typing because like that's where some of the best ideas have come from.
You had a Desert Bates story that you did on the air. Elijah Johnson had one. Did Nora ever do one? N.K. Jemisin? I don't think she did.
It's hard. I know David did. I know
Paul
Chris
did.
Dykeman did. Paul did.
Paul Berger.
Paul Berger. I should say Mercurio de Rivera. Elijah Don Johnson. I did one. That might have been it.
Tom Crossell?
Did Tom do it? I don't remember.
I'm trying to remember. He might have.
He might have. And I'm also, I feel like, did Lila Wilde do it?
No, she is not.
She did not. Okay.
Because I only even met her once, and that was when we recorded you in an office.
Was it Lauren McLaughlin?
Yes.
It was Lauren McLaughlin.
Yes, it was.
I don't remember the story that she read. Do you remember it?
I don't, but I have the recording somewhere.
Yeah. I'm blanking on what she had read.
Because at least then we were in the digital era.
Right.
The oxide era, I have to transfer all of those into digital. But the digital era, I've got all of those.
Right.
But I was just thinking. I mean, that's what prompted this conversation. Wouldn't it be fascinating to do one in the commons?
It would be. It would be really cool to do that. You know, I wanted to...
Maybe even as a special nurse.
Yeah. Like the story I was going to mention that I have out right now, Demon in Aisle 6, which you produced the audio, the podcast for.
Stefan Rudnicki produced it.
I was the audio editor.
And when Paul Bamer is the reader, there's not a lot of editing to be done. He's amazing. He generally he knows his words.
Yeah.
He don't make mistakes. I more proof him. Some people need severe editing.
Yeah.
He doesn't have too many retakes. And
it was a very good reading of the story. It's Demon in Aisle 6. It's in Nightmare Magazine. It was in the November issue.
Hosted by Jack Kincaid.
Jack Kincaid, correct. And that story was workshopped in Altered Fluid.
Ah, okay.
And what I
remember... I mean, we're not discussing that this morning, but I had questions about that story.
Okay.
Well, like, where did that lead character come from? Because that character doesn't resemble you very closely in terms of certain preferences.
In terms of their sexual orientation, is what Correct. You're saying. I think...
This is a story that could have gone in Lightspeed's Queers Destroy Fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
The first podcast of which should have gone live about an hour and a half ago, hosted by Ellen Kushner. And my God, I spent all... I'm so tired now because I spent all bleeping day editing that and creating a new sound for that and music and everything. Yeah. And I don't even get credit on that. But anyway.
Well, I mean, you know, you like, where does that come from? Okay, well...
Where in your life did that resonate?
I think
it's also a good horror story.
Thank you.
Although it's sort of a light, dark story.
It's a light, dark story. I mean, no spoilers, but yeah.
No, you can tell from the tone. It's sort of like from the Robert Bloch era, Richard Matheson era of horror, if they had the...
It might correctly be termed like a dark fantasy story rather than horror. It's like less like full of dread and despair. It's I don't want to say it's hopeful, but there's something there which I don't think traditional horror has. But so like, you know, I think it's that thing. It's like you say, oh, this writer wrote a story about X. Does that mean the writer is X? No, of course not. It doesn't. It's just.
But it's usually write what you know.
I mean, I think it comes down to being able to envision yourself as someone else, and what would motivate that. I mean, look,
is an actor's studio method of writing in a way.
I mean, isn't that? I mean, that's how I write characters. I put myself in their heads. I mean, mm-hmm. like, I'm not a demon king, obviously, but I wrote about one in King of Shards, right?
Which we're going to get to in a moment.
Which we're going to get to. You know, I'm not a 20-year-old Mason architect, you know, woman. I'm not a, Lamed Vavnik works for a charity in New York City. I mean, so, like, you put your head in these characters and imagine, you know, what their motivations are, what they want, and then, yeah, do I draw things from my life? Absolutely. I mean, I think that in that story in particular, the issue of someone coming into my life and essentially with much more world experience, let's say, than I had at that time,
mm-hmm.
and kind of influenced me in ways which ultimately were harmful and hurtful, that I later came to recognize as destructive. But at the time, I didn't see that. And then it was just the overwhelming force of one personality on another in a destructive way. And I think that's the core of that story. And, you know, the sexual relationship was just me kind of wanting to explore that, because I've written gay characters before, but I've never written a gay love story before.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I want to do this. So anyway.
Well, anyhow, if people want to read that story, mm-hmm. you can go to nightmare-magazine.com and read it or listen to it.
That's right. It's in the November issue. It might be like three or four stories down at this point, or you can just click on the November issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but it's only two podcasts down.
Two podcasts down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that I know, because I live with those. It's so much fun. And coincidental that I got that, that I followed Raj Khanna,
mm-hmm.
who had been doing that job.
Yeah. I mean, you've both been doing a great job.
And that triangulates because of John Joseph Adams, who mm-hmm. was on the show 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, King of Shards.
Yes.
part of, I'm sorry, I've blanked on the name of the trilogy.
The World Mender trilogy.
Right, of course. Of course it is. Give us a pricey, as Dadlow would say.
Well, King of Shards is about a Lamed Vav. And a Lamed Vav is an ancient myth that says that there are 36 just people who sustain the world. If any one of them were to cease being righteous, to cease being just, the world would be destroyed. It's on account of their righteousness that the world is sustained. Now, the interesting...
This is not a biblical story, but it is a traditional story.
It's actually in the Talmud.
Oh, it is in
the Talmud. Yes, in Sanhedrin. And
Barbara Krasnoff wrote a story about them, some years back.
Yeah, it's a great myth, but here's the cool thing about the myth, is that the Lamed Vav, these 36 just people, are anonymous. So that you or I could be one of these saints and never know it. Yeah. You could be walking along the street and meet a Lamed Vavnik and not know it. Okay? So the idea is that you should strive to be a righteous, a just person yourself, because you might be sustaining the world, and you should be kind and generous and, loving, et cetera, to the stranger, because he or she or whomever might also be a Lamed Vavnik. So in King of Shards, Daniel Fisher is a Lamed Vavnik, and on his wedding day, he's snatched away into a Gehenna, basically, which is, you might call, a version of Jewish hell, by none other than Ashmedai, the king of the demons. Mm-hmm. And Ashmedai has been kicked out of Sheol, which is another hell world in King of Shards, and by none other than his wife, Mashit. And so Ashmedai tells Daniel, look, there are demons that are trying to kill the Lamed Vav to destroy the earth. You and I need to team up to stop them. So what follows is that the king of the demons and the saint that upholds the world have to team up to basically protect the world from being destroyed. Now, there is a lot more to the story than that, but that is the jumping-off point.
As I said, the pre-seed.
I
said as Statler would say, because I used to do online interviews for Omni Magazine and then Event Horizon, and she and I would have a private chat going, and I would be thinking of where's the question, and I would always get from her, Jim, ask the precise, and I'm going, ask the precise?
What? Yeah, yeah.
I had to look the word up. So,
the other myth that I play with is the myth of the shattered vessels. So in the 16th century in Safed, there was this Kabbalistic rabbi, his name was Isaac Luria, and he came up with this idea of the shattered vessels that when God first created the world, the world wasn't strong enough essentially to hold God's light, and so it shattered. And all these fragments spread to the far corners of existence. And so he came up with this notion of tikkun olam, which means to repair the world. And basically, it is our job in the world as righteous people to collect these fragments, these sparks, and lift them up. That's when you hear a Jewish person say raising the holy sparks, that's what they're talking about. Yeah. Tikkun olam, repairing the world, bringing these broken fragments into wholeness again. Now, there have been elaborations on this myth that it wasn't just one world that was shattered, but there were many worlds that were shattered before ours. So our universe wasn't the first world that was created. There were other worlds created before ours. So I thought,
And that's a myth that Roger Zelazny has taken from.
Sure.
And
it's been used.
He always played with myths.
It's been used a lot. And I thought to myself,
So that was a great video game. I'm trying to remember what it was, but go on.
Yeah, I was going to say, what if, you know, I thought, what if these primordial worlds weren't empty? What if they were inhabited by sentient, intelligent beings that, and then God said, you know what, they're a little too evil, I'm going to destroy them. And so in King of Shards, this is the origin of demons. They were the sentient beings on these worlds that were shattered. A lot of them died when God smashed their worlds, but a few of them survived and settled on the shard, the fragment world, Sheol. And also in King of Shards, there are humans and demons living on another fragment world called Gehinnom, Gehenna. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that these are the origins of the myth, the myth of Sheol as the Jewish underworld, the kind of Hades, and then Gehenna, which came later, which really meant like a place of burning, a place of constant fires, becomes Gehinnom. And so, I basically am playing with a lot of Judaic myths. Some of them, a couple millennia old, and some of them, several centuries old. And I kind of put them all into this big mix and stir. I heard a phone ring.
Yeah, so did I. I have no idea which or where, but yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think it's this. Let me, radio. Let's try this one. Radio. Oh, wow. Go on. But you know what? We should get to the reading.
We should get to the reading, sure. So I'm going to read a pretty short section from...
One second, let me just... hi there, I'm on the air. Okay, now there's somebody calling all these different numbers, but...
Maybe they're war dialing, like in war games. They're just going through
the
phone book.
That's what it is, yeah. That's what it is, yes, exactly.
All right, I'm going to read this... this section, I think it should be about a 10 or 15 minute read. If you want me to just stop, let me know.
If we're getting close, because it is already sadly 2:35.
Yeah.
I'll give you a cellophane wrap up sign.
I'm just gonna.
Should I get you a cup of water?
No, I got my coffee right here. I'm good.
Okay, very good.
So I'm gonna just give you just a brief intro. I'm not reading from the beginning. There are three main point of view characters in King of Shards. There's Ashmedai, who's king of the demons, Daniel Fisher, who's the Lamed Vavnik that I was talking about before, and there's Rana, who I mentioned, who is a mason/architect from Gehinnom. She's 20 years old, and she's astoundingly creative. And the fourth person, it's not a point of view character, but she's a main character. Her name is Marul Menacha, and she's a witch and an old friend of Rana. This is about maybe a quarter of the way into the book. Her scream was the only thing in the whole world. Then it had stopped. Everything had stopped, all but her heart, which hammered like chisel on stone. Am I alive? She thought. Or is this the netherworld? She lay on her back. It didn't seem to be broken. Breathe. Breathe. Except for her fear, she felt little pain. Perhaps the pain would come. She slowly opened her eyes. A dozen corpse faces stared down at her, a circle around her head, like the constellations of Matzaroth belting the night sky. Their eyes glowed as if candles burned within. Their presence should have frightened her, but she felt oddly calmed by their silent breathing. The chiseling of her heart slowed by degrees. I am Yig, one said, his voice like hide being stripped from flesh. You are safe. Yig's face came into focus. He looked much like Grug, but Yig's cheekbones were higher, a relation, perhaps. As a friend of the king, Yig said, you are welcome in Yarrow. The others nodded and mumbled their agreement. King Jalifex, she said, her voice hoarse from screaming. No, not that engorged human. I speak of our lord, King Ashmedai. Oh, you mean Caleb. Yig shook his head. In his presence you must call him my lord. They helped her sit up. Never, she said. She thought it best not to reveal how she just tried to kill their lord. She rubbed her temples. What happened? Grug broke your fall with his voice. The sound knocked you unconscious. We brought you here to let you rest. She felt sick as she remembered the hideous moment of free fall. While falling, she'd had a vision. She was older, it was years from now, and her sister Lou was weeping at Rana's empty grave. The vision had been more horrific than her impending oblivion. I almost let my sister grow up alone, she thought. I abandoned her without thinking. But by some miracle, goddess be praised, she had survived. Because of Grug, no less. Rana decided to rethink her hatred of the cursed man. Where are the others, the people I was with? The king and his companions have arrived in Yarrow. They are heading to the Lev as we speak. Mistress, drink this. He offered her a stone cup, a dark liquid sloshed inside. What is it? A wine fermented from the fungus that grows in these caves. The same fungus that grows on Kippad's Stair? You know the Grail? Not by name. I thought it eats you from the inside out. It does. But fermented, the Grail is medicine. Like all things, its nature is manifold. She stared into the cup. If they wanted to kill her, she wouldn't be here. Plus, it was rude to refuse a drink from those who'd given her succor. She took a sip. It was bitter as cackroot, but she felt her spirits lift. She took another sip as they watched. Her head began to clear, and she examined her surroundings. She sat on a stone plinth in a circular chamber. The walls were black granite with veins of obsidian and calcite. Torches burned in the four corners of the room. The orange-yellow light darted haphazardly about the room's odd angles like furtive sparrows. Arcing doors led off into other chambers. If you're well enough to walk, Mistress Yig said, we'll escort you to the Lev. The king will meet us there. Does he know I'm alive? He requested your presence as soon as you were able. I see, she said, doubtful she would escape these caves without a map. Besides, Marul was still with Caleb. She had to return to them, rescue Marul, and take her home. Yig gestured toward the door. Our lord awaits. She frowned, wiped dust from her tunic. Let's go see your lord. They entered a tunnel wider than the broadest streets of Azru. The two walked ahead while the other Mikulalim followed a few paces behind. Torches along the walls blinkered to life with spell-laden whispers as they moved. From high, recessed windows shivered furtive shapes of Mikulalim peering down at them. The walls echoed the steely sounds of their desolation. They walked through a labyrinth of crooked avenues. Stone stairs led into strange corners, buttresses bent at vulgar angles, and steep walls leaned oppressively over all. Distantly, a flute was piping some maddening, indefinite tune. She shivered and remembered the legends of the Black Chasm, of the Cursed One's dreadful bacchanals, whose music drove men to madness. What is this place? She said. This is Yarrow, mistress, our city. A city? How many of you live down here? 100,000 Mikulalim, give or take. More than twice the population of Azru. She shook her head in awe. I've lived in Azru my entire life without knowing another city sits just under my own. What else, she wondered, was so close that she could not see it? She drank in the city with thirsty eyes, afraid to miss the littlest details. Ornate stone bridges arced across the streets, doorways appeared in unexpected places, and corners met at unnecessary angles. At first the city seemed haphazard, random, but she began to sense a subtle artistry in it, a purposeful disjointedness. My father taught me to set stones in a predetermined order, she said, to know your destination before you begin. I hadn't realized I could embrace chaos and still craft something marvelous. All things are born from chaos, said Yig. I don't see any joints or seams, she said. Your stonework is incredible. How did you mortise the block so well? There are no mortises. There are no seams. But that would mean... Yarrow was not built like the cities in the sun, Yig said, with stone piled upon stone. It was built by taking stone away. You excavated Yarrow? She let loose a little yelp. She'd always assumed that the art was crafted by combining simple forms to build complexity. I've freed statues from marble and chiseled the crypt of Umar out of the side of the Danbar Mountain, but an entire city loosed from stone? It's beyond words. Ideas for projects unfurled spectacularly in her mind. The frenzied piping grew louder. As they stepped into an enormous cavern, Rana stopped, struck by the gargantuan size of the space. Azru